Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Among the many scientific conferences hosted in Edmonton this summer was the one for the Intelligent Systems for Molecular Biology. 1,500 researchers from 40 countries gathered to discuss the latest concerns in the exciting new field of computational biology. Dr. David Wishard chaired the conference, and he talks about some of the emerging trends. And a small but diverse group of British travelers stopped over in Lac La Biche. They were on a fact-finding mission to see how Canadians stack up in the Department of Sustainable Forest Management. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Just one look at the agenda for the week-long ISMB 2002 conference told me I was entering a new frontier. There was the session on marginalized kernels for biological sequences, and then another one entitled A Powerful Non-Homology Method for the Prediction of Operons in Prokaryotes. While it was all Greek to me, these topics and more just like them were enough to attract over 1,500 researchers from around the world to come to Edmonton to discuss intelligent systems for molecular biology. Dr. David Wishart, a professor of pharmacology at the University of Alberta, chaired the ISMB 2002 conference.
ISMB is the Intelligent Systems for Molecular Biology, and it's a conference that's been going on for about 10 years now. In fact, this was the 10th one held here. We had about 1,500 delegates attend from 40 different countries, and it's been growing by leaps and bounds almost every year. And the reason why it's grown is because it's certainly one of the most exciting and rapidly growing areas in all of life sciences. It brings together computer scientists with biologists, and I think it's been shown many times that often the most interesting things happen when you bring two very different disciplines together, and it's that interface of you know, oil and water, that mixing that leads to some very exciting and new science and new fields. So what ISMB or the ISMB conference does is allow people to present their science. We had some 50 presentations of speakers or through many of the students to show off the work they're doing in posters, and we had almost 500 of those. And the type of research that they do in computational biology ranges from trying to unravel the human genome, deciphering what it means, to sorting out the pathways of evolution, finding the tree of life, if you want to call it that, to trying to simulate life on a computer, what a cell would do and how it would behave, what an embryo would do and how it would behave, to making predictions of how proteins or genes look and fold and act. And this is an area of considerable interest, particularly even in Edmonton, where there's an interest in nanotechnology. And the techniques that are being described here may have a very significant impact on how the next big wave, nanotechnology, will evolve over the next 10 years.
The thing that really struck me is the youth. Looking around the audience gathered here for the final closing presentations, and even one of the poster winners, I couldn't even believe he was old enough to be in university, let alone to be here at a conference dealing with these topics of such tremendous importance and a difficulty from my perspective. This certainly must lend itself to the excitement and the newness of this field.
Oh, indeed, yeah. We had a large number of students this year. We were fortunate to get a significant support from a number of local agencies, the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, Alberta Ingenuity, University of Alberta, as well as some major granting agencies in the United States. And we were able to bring in more than 100 students on fellowships. Many others came from the University of Alberta, students who wanted to show their stuff off. We probably had close to 400 or 500 people of university age presenting. And I think it's a reflection of the field that this is a new frontier. It's attracting many young people, and many people are making a switch. They started off in biology, and now they're in bioinformatics. They started off computing science, and now they're in computational biology. they're catching the fever, and that youthful enthusiasm, I think, has really made the conference exciting and really enjoyable, especially for the old guard.
Well, the old guard can't be that old either.
No, in fact, probably, I mean, the oldest individual here might only be in their mid-50s, actually. It is a new field. It's evolving very rapidly. And I think because of that newness, I think we're always going to be, coming close to that edge of, you know, is that possible? Is that, or these breakthrough ideas, is there something that we'd never thought of? And I think young people have a capacity of thinking outside the box and bringing in fresh ideas that we hadn't thought of. And there were some examples, I think, this conference where people had some just remarkable insights that made things so much faster, so much simpler.
What are some of those insights? What are the directions that emerged at this conference?
Well, much of the conference, there's discussions on techniques, but I would say that some clear trends are emerging in this field. One is the idea of simulating. It's called systems biology. It's trying to explain biology not in terms of a single cell or a single enzyme, but as a collection of thousands and thousands of different enzymes or different cells, this sort of collective. And that's really what biological systems are, is that they interact with each other. It's like our environment and our ecosystem. You can't explain everything by just talking about a single tree. So systems biology is emerging as an important field. It's something that is so complicated that we have to depend utterly on computers to use, to simulate, to predict, to model systems biology. So that's a major trend. We had a record number of posters in that area. I think another area of active research is trying to unravel the human genome. We have the template. We've got the sequence. We've had it for about 2 years now. But we're still trying to figure out what it codes for and how it works. And this is called an annotation problem. It's like you've got a whole bunch of words, and now you've got to get definitions for them. And this is a major effort for biologists all over the world. It's like creating a new language almost. And you know, now that we've read the DNA language, we're going to have to translate it into English and make it decipherable for not only the scientists, but for the public, for the medical practitioners, for the people who are going to benefit from this major advance. I think other trends that have emerged this year, they're using intelligent machines, the fields of artificial intelligence, to help solve problems in biology. Things called machine learning, computers that can learn by watching and training the same way that we learn by watching or training, are starting to be able to analyze the vast amount of biological data, and they're able to tease out patterns that none of us could have seen, and some of them are surprising. This year we had the Overton Award. This is the top prize for the ISMB meeting. It was awarded to David Baker from the University of Washington, an outstanding young scientist, who's figured out a way of predicting how proteins fold up into their three-dimensional structure. And this is a powerful program that's just so much better than anything else that's ever been developed. And people have been trying for 40 years. This is a breakthrough, a very, very significant breakthrough that might have an impact on drug discovery and drug development, and nanotechnology, and just in our basic understanding of biology and how life happens.
What's happening in Alberta?
Alberta is a very active center in the field of computational biology and bioinformatics. There's been a number of initiatives that have just been funded or about to be funded. We have a large number of researchers at the University of Alberta and at the University of Calgary. Some of them have just been recruited. Some of them are migrating into the field. They may have been biologists and now finding themselves in computational biology. Others are computer scientists and are drifting in that area. There are important initiatives in areas of cancer, of cellular simulation, visual genomics, initiatives that are bringing some outstanding people together. And this is one of the reasons why this conference was held in Edmonton and in Alberta, was because of the reputation not only of the researchers in Alberta, but also the spin-offs, the companies that have spun off, such as BioTools or Canomics or Agrigenomics, that are actively using computational biology to advance their products and their disciplines.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Cheryl.
That was Dr. David Wishart, professor of pharmacology at the University of Alberta and the chair of the ISMB 2002 conference on informatics and computational biology. At the end of July, I accepted an invitation to travel to Lac La Biche and dine with some visitors from the United Kingdom. They were here as guests of the Canadian government to have a look at forest practices in various parts of the country. The group had just finished a bus tour through part of Alberta Pacific's forest management area. Chatting with the guests before dinner provided some interesting insight into the relationship between science and research and economic activity. I asked Danielle de Belfou from Canada's High Commission in London about the purpose of the tour.
This is part of a program that has been in existence for about 10 years, whereby we bring people who have something to do with the forest industry in a certain number of countries where the environmental movement has been quite active in the past in creating an image of Canadian forestry. Those countries typically include the UK, Holland, Germany, Japan more and more, sometimes the United States. So essentially we bring people who can have an influence on the views of Canadian forestry from those countries. We bring them over to Canada to show them how forestry is done, essentially to dispel some myth.
What is the perspective from the English side of Canadian forestry?
Well, essentially that Canadian forestry is bad. And from the comments I've got from several people, the image of the Brazil of the North is still imprinted in the mind of the man on the street, if I can say. The industry knows better. The buyers of forest product, be it pulp, paper, newsprint, timber product, engineered wood product, these people know better. But of course, the man on the street seems that they have room in their brain for maybe, you know, a couple of image about whatever, and that image for Canada seems to be the Brazil of the North, which had been conveyed many, many years ago. I'm not sure if we'll be able to dispel this myth, but in the meantime, we bring people who are involved one way or another with forest products, and to try to get them to understand the reality of Canadian forestry.
I know this is a whirlwind tour and you're only halfway through, but are you getting any feedback?
We'll find out at the end of the tour. We have a debriefing session where we, for about an hour and a half, we trash it out and we ask people how, what have they have seen, what they have learned, what they appreciated, what they didn't like. We'll find out.
But you must hear some chit-chat on the bus.
Yes. Yes, I think we're getting there bit by bit. Again, some of those people are not. I mean, it's not forestry sustainability is not their business. These people buy wood, trade wood, use wood. It's only part of their profession, and of course, on this trip, they're totally invested in forestry for a limited period of time. So, of course, for some of them, it's quite an eye-opener. And some of the comments I've gotten so far are to the effect that the reality is perhaps a little more complicated than they thought it was.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
That was Danielle de Belfou of Canada's High Commission Office in London. Among the British visitors was Tim Rawlinson, a forestry policy expert with the Forestry Commission in the United Kingdom.
Well, we're over here as guests of the Canadian government. So there's a delegation of us, different people involved in forestry in a variety of ways in the United Kingdom. And we've been in New Brunswick, and we're in Alberta for 2 days, and then we go off to British Columbia for another 2 or 3 days.
Now, you've been brought over by the Canadian government. Why?
to see forestry across Canada, really. And they're just trying to show us what goes on and give us an understanding of what they're trying to achieve.
Is there a concern over trade between the two countries?
There has been, yeah, but that's not a big issue at the moment. We don't have many forests in the UK, and we import about 85% of our wood needs. We only grow 15%, so a very different position from Canada. So we have a big impact on forests overseas, so that's partly why I'm interested in seeing what's happening and what impact are we having by using wood from all sorts of countries around the world, including Canada.
What did you do today?
We went out to see forests, managed crown lands being managed by ALPAC, get a feel for the way in which they're trying to manage them sustainably, and we're trying to get a view as to whether we think the forests are being managed sustainably or not and how that compares with practice in the UK and in other countries.
What you saw today, what stands out for you?
I think what stands out for me is the way in which the industry are working with the Crown people very closely in terms of trying to understand the science of forestry and the impact that the logging is having on the long term, and trying to adjust the management practices to make sure that they're not going to have too much of a severe impact. And I guess partly to see how the foresters are trying to mimic some of nature, particularly the fires that take place naturally, and they're trying to adjust the logging practices to be more natural than maybe they would have been in the past.
How does that compare to what's going on in your country and with Europe?
Well, the big difference for me is just the scale of what happens here. I mean, Alberta alone has 20 times the forest area that we've got in the whole of the UK. And yet, I don't know what the population of Alberta is, but our population is 60 million, and here it must be just a small number of millions. So, you know, you've got probably 60 times the forest resource per head of population that we've got. So it's just seeing the scale of it is quite fantastic, really.
From a consumer point of view, do you think you'd be able to take back some good words, or what would be your concerns?
Well, I visited forests in Canada about 15 years ago, and I, at that time, I have to say, I would have been a bit concerned about some of the practices, the logging practices. They didn't look like the forests were being managed too well in terms of making sure that the forests were being regenerated. And that's what I've seen here is hugely different to what I saw then, and the language that people are using indicates that they care about what they're doing and making sure they're putting something back as well as taking something out. And that's, for us as consumers, is very important to know that the forests are being managed responsibly. So that's the message I go back with, is actually what's going on here is pretty good, really.
Where do you head off to tomorrow?
We're still in the same area. We're going off to see a bit more of the forests. And then in the afternoon we head off to British Columbia, where I'm sure we'll see something quite different with the old growth forests. And we've got 3 days there, so we're all looking forward to that.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
That was Tim Rawlinson of the Forestry Commission in the United Kingdom. Offering up another perspective on forest sustainability was Mark Campanelli. Mark is the Associate Director of Business Development for Socially Responsible Business Investment for a company called Henderson Global Investors.
Well, Henderson, we manage about $225 billion Canadian, and we invest around the world in different companies. And I'm here to look at how sustainability can be applied to different companies which are operating in Canada, and to try and look at what is best practice from a sustainability point of view.
What has been your practice up to this point?
Historically, investors have tended not to look at sustainability, but increasingly in recent years, the public are now demanding that the money they have invested with us takes into account a wide range of social, environmental, and ethical factors. And I'm part of a range of funds. We have about, in Canadian dollars, about $3-4 billion that uses sustainable criteria. And one of the funds we run here is for a company called Mackenzie. It's a global ethical investment fund which tries to incorporate sustainability into the investment decision making.
Does science and research come into that equation?
It does. Science and research is important, and the way we do it is, as well as having traditional fund managers that do financial analysis, we have a team of about 7 or 8 which work only on ecological factors and social factors. And my background is as an agricultural economist. My specialization was in environmental cost accounting techniques. But what we see now is that investors, big bankers and investment managers, have got to take all the skills from the science, ecologists, biologists, and actually use their skills to help them make better investment decisions, ones that look at society and the environment from a holistic perspective.
What have you seen so far on this tour?
Well, one of the things I've seen is that confirms that if you're involved in logging, there's no way of getting around it. It's a very high-impact industry. But different companies do it in different ways. And that if you're going to have to manage forests, you can do it selectively, you can do it scientifically, and you can do it in a way which minimizes its impact on non-timber values, by which I mean habitat, species, the ecosystem as a whole. I do have some concerns. Primarily is that if you're not inside a national park, commercial developers will develop your area of forests. And if they're going to do that, there's going to be some significant impacts on the forests. And on a historical basis, commercial developments increased rapidly in the last 30, 40 years. And we don't know how significant that impact is if we look in the context of the forests who've been there for hundreds of years or thousands of years. We don't know what the impacts are on the biosystems, the local species and habitats. If we look at it as a system as a whole, we don't know yet what the impacts are. My fear is that the impacts are going to be significantly greater than what the logging industry will lead us to believe.
What stands out for you from what you've seen so far in Nova Scotia and here? And I know you still have to go to British Columbia.
The management of forests is, without doubt, a very controversial area, because when you look at an area which has been logged, it's very different from what it was before it was logged. The debate about how those forests are going to be managed and whether logging extensively, clear-cutting, or even partially clear-cutting, what the long-term biological impacts are, I think there's a long way to go before everyone is happy and there's consensus between the conservation movement and the business interests are on what those long-term impacts are.
Are you getting a sense at this point of what you could take back home with you to England and say to people?
Yeah, I think we've got to accept that commercial interests are there. It's going to happen. But we've got to find appropriate standards. And the message I'm taking back to our investors back in the UK is that the Forest Stewardship Council certification of forests does seem to be the best and most appropriate standard that people should be using. And the recommendations that I've made to my colleagues is that FSC should be the standard that we all use to measure appropriate forestry management practices when we look at companies around the world before we invest, whether in Scandinavia, Australia, or Canada, and that we've got to come up with an acceptable measurement system to determine what is best practice so as to encourage others to move towards a more socially responsible and appropriate forestry management practice.
Thank you very much.
Ah, great, thanks very much.
That was Mark Campanelli of Henderson Global Investors. Looking at things from an academic perspective was Dr. Christine Gaharland. She is a lecturer at the University of Wales in Bangor, and she teaches tree identification, silviculture, and genetics.
There's a lot of similarities, of course. I mean, a lot of the sort of silviculture that we've seen on the TRIF has been very similar to the things that we do in the UK, but there are big differences too, particularly in the way that the publicly owned lands are managed, I think. That's the one thing that struck me most about this visit.
In what way? What's different?
Well, the big difference is that in most European countries, the publicly owned land is managed by a state forest service, whereas what seems to happen here is that there's a state forest service which sets objectives, but then the management plans are drawn up by industrial companies, private individuals, and they're the people who implement them on the ground, and that's very different from Europe.
It's different, but do you think there's a problem?
No, it seems to work pretty well, actually. It's just it's a surprised reaction, really, because it's so different from the way that it's done in Europe. But no, it seems, as far as I can see, it works pretty well on the ground. I have no adverse comments on the silviculture that I've seen so far.
On this tour, what have you seen in terms of what's happening in the research and the science side of forestry?
We haven't seen very much of that. We've been concentrating on the management. But we did, yesterday in New Brunswick, we visited a tree improvement program, which I was very interested in. That's one of my sort of research areas. And again, that was quite similar to a lot of the programs we have in Europe. Some of the details were different, and I found that quite interesting. And we've heard a little bit today in Alberta about some of the ecological research, and that's obviously driven some of the changes in forest management. So that's very encouraging to hear and quite interesting for us. I think probably in that respect you're a little bit ahead of the UK.
What are the concerns from a research perspective, the way you see things? When you're teaching and you're doing your research, what are the concerns for you?
I think as far as this trip's concerned, one of the things that I would be interested in, I'm interested in genetics and genetic diversity, so I'm quite interested in the way that silviculture and forest management might reduce genetic diversity in tree populations. And actually that's an area that worldwide we know very little about. And I think Canada might be a place where you could do some very interesting studies, you know, comparing untouched areas that are just driven by fire with harvested areas and look to see what the effects are on the genetic variation in the tree populations.
Do your students or the consumers of our timber products, do you think they've got a good handle on what's going on, or is there a gap, a wide gap between what's really happening and what they think is happening?
I think there's a big gap between public perceptions and reality. In the UK, forestry in general has a pretty bad press. And, particularly, we get stories from Western Canada about large-scale clear-cutting and non-sustainable forest management, and it's not really reflecting reality. And I think the forestry profession worldwide does not do a very good job of explaining to the public what's going on in forestry and exactly what it is they're doing. And we really should address that problem. I don't have any easy answers, but it's something we need to look at pretty hard, I think.
What message will you take back?
Well, I'll be talking to the students next academic year, and I'll be showing them some of the photographs that I've taken out here. And I think I'll be telling them that Canadian forests are extremely well managed and it's fine to be importing wood from Canada. And we have an exchange program with the university in Vancouver, and I'll be encouraging our students to take advantage of that and go out and see for themselves.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Dr. Christine Gaharland of the University of Wales in Bangor. I also spoke with Mark Campanelli, Tim Rawlinson, and Danielle de Belfou. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. You can listen to past programs on our website at innovationalberta.com. The program is sponsored by Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, National Institute for Nanotechnology, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, True North Energy, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Research Council, Alberta Conservation Association, and the Health Sciences Association of Alberta. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.